It's religion today, it's ideology today, and our secularist friends also have a faith.
Some kind of Disneyland fantasy.
I know how this is going to get heard in the secular world.
The pseudo-Christian masks are off.
That's nonsense, ladies and gentlemen.
Apologetics isn't just about giving answers to other people's questions. It's also about learning to question other people's answers or even question the question itself.
In a Christian worldview.
Welcome to Quantum of Solace, number 100. Can you believe it already? Episode number 100. I feel that we should have our own Quantum Oscars. Why not? Let's just self-congratulate ourselves about how wonderful we are and how essential we are for humanity. And now, I am going to admit a bias here. I hate the Oscars. I never watch the Oscars. I know instantly I would start throwing things at the television because they're a bunch of rich, connected, elitist people who virtue signal all the time, whose influence on humanity is, in my view, yeah, sometimes good, sometimes some great films, but largely banal. As regular listeners to this podcast will know, I try to avoid Hollywood films like The Plague, if possible. And I do prefer the kind of more foreign language art house type films. But the Oscars, oh, now we've got to say something about them, because without having watched them, I'll take a rough stab. And Al, by the way, did you watch them?
No.
No. Okay. You didn't watch them. Well, okay. So I'll take a rough stab at this. Guess what? I suspect that there were lots of tears and wanting to thank everyone and their uncle. I suspect that there were lots of glitzy gowns. I suspect that there was a lot of digs at Donald Trump and, oh, how wonderful we are and how terrible he is. And I have suspicion. I've heard, in fact, no, I did see the clip of this where they actually got the nomination wrong, which I thought was absolutely wonderful. Now, two things in terms of serious comment that I want to say that I think are particularly relevant for us. The first is the five international directors who wrote a letter which was paraded all over the place saying, again, a dig at Donald Trump and going against nationalism and upholding universal human rights.
It's not important which countries and which religion or gender or whatever Trump wants to ban. And so, we were all affected. It's the foreign language category.
That's what foreign film can do. And it's not just from our five countries, but we actually represent all countries. So that's what the statement is for us. We're against the travel ban. We're against that people judge each other. And that's what, you know, movies are supposed to bring people together in that sense. So, yeah.
I think it's reflective of what we've seen in broader American society. Like, there's thousands of people on the streets protesting this sort of thing. You know, your democratic institutions, your courts, effectively saying, no, this is not on. So we've got to remember that. It's not all sort of like some madman like coming up with some racist, stupid idea. It's like everyone coming back and saying, no, you can't do that. I mean, a lot of Americans have said, look, we're so embarrassed. And said, like, don't be embarrassed. Be proud. This is like a great struggle that you've got on your hands and you're doing well so far.
Now, it's a fascinating letter, much of which I would agree with. Except I just have this one question. What are universal human rights and who determines what they are? So, is it a universal human right for life? Does that include the child in the womb? Is it a universal human right that I can marry whoever I want? Does that include if I want to marry 10 people? What are universal human rights? Al is waving frantically at me here with his headphones and his really cool glasses. People, by the way, who have really cool glasses don't use them to see. They just use them to look really cool. But he is telling me that we are just producing a short, which will be up, I believe, by the time this podcast is up, where Andy Bannister is talking about the basis for human rights.
I was recently on the Facebook page for the British Humanist Association, and I was really excited to see a quote they had there. They produced a beautiful graphic with a quote from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that talks in glowing terms about the inherent dignity of every member of the human family and the basis that thus gives us for human rights and justice. And I read it and I thought, fantastic, I completely agree. But on the other hand, I'm puzzled. What's it doing on the Facebook page for a well-known atheist organization? Why do I say that? Well, the problem is, talking about human dignity, especially inherent dignity of human beings, is basically impossible if you're an atheist. I'm sorry to be that direct. It's impossible for this reason. You see, human rights is based on human dignity and human value. And where does that come from on atheism?
There we go. There's synergy for you. There's good working together. Have a look at that. It seems to me that you cannot have absolute human rights without having an absolute. And then we come back, therefore, to where Christianity comes in. Because as Christians, we believe in human rights, but we've got a much more substantial basis for them than the rather fickle universal human rights means, whatever Hollywood says universal human rights means. And then the second thing, Moonlight. Against all the odds, they said. Shock that it won. Really, really. Forgive my cynicism. Hollywood, which just got blasted for being a mainly white, male, middle-class elitist, suddenly discovers that it's able to have a black actor playing a gay coming-out story, and gosh, that's a shock that it won. For me, it would have been an absolute shock if it hadn't won. No, it just doesn't work like that. What I want to know is, what happened with the likes of films like Silence and other brilliant films? I mean, I guess Silence, you know, it's just about a bunch of persecuted Japanese Roman Catholics from 400 years ago. Who bothers? No, the Oscars are a very narrow worldview, which increasingly shows me that I have no interest in Hollywood. And Hollywood has no interest, really, in the rest of the world. Now, speaking of Hollywood and Disney, I often use the term Disney to talk about an unreal world, you know, because pigs don't really talk and deer are not really Bambi and all the rest of it. And, you know, at one level, Disney's harmless and it's done some wonderfully good stuff and so on. But unfortunately, it's beginning to get a bit too big for its boots, and it's beginning, well, not beginning, actually. It's thinking how it can use the culture to put forward a particular cultural viewpoint. And here we go again. Disney's film version of Beauty and the Beast, the new one, it's widely rumoured there's going to be a homosexual partnership in that. And then, of course, there has been the first Disney cartoon characters with a gay kiss on screen. Who cares? What's this about? This is about what British soap operas have been used for. Now, just to let you into the history of this, after the Second World War, radio soap operas were used by the British government. They were basically dramas about family life. Why were they called soap operas? Because they were used to encourage people to use soap. And now what we're getting in our dramas is the next sexual revolution that our culture elites want us to have. They're going to use mainstream media in order to normalize and push it across. And they do particularly aim at children. Which brings me on to the ongoing scenario of the majority of Scottish MSPs now apparently are backing LGBT education compulsory for all children in Scotland. Now, I will repeat it again, and I will repeat it ad nauseum. This is not about preventing bullying of LGBT pupils. It's not. We all agree that we'd want to stop bullying, but I think bullying of many other kinds as well. And this is not even just about sex education. This is about indoctrinating children in history, in science, in English, into an LGBT curriculum, teaching a particular sexual philosophy. And I feel it is profoundly harmful. And I feel it has consequences which people have not sought through yet. Now, that brings us on to our next subject. I've been saying for a while that the next cultural changes in our society will also all be sexual. There'll be prostitution turned into sex work. It will be polygamy, and it will be paedophilia. Now, most people think paedophilia, that won't happen. In my view, I think it will. And here's how. I think there'll be a drip, drip, drip effect. And there are people who have recognized that. I have an article that I found quite fascinating, and I would suggest that you have a look at it, by R. Scott Clark, which came out last Monday, and entitled The Normalization of Paedophilia Approaches. So I think there will be that. Peter Tatchell, somebody sent me an old letter from Peter Tatchell that he wrote to The Guardian, in which he suggested that that wasn't wrong. And I do wonder where all this is going, because this week there was also an extraordinary story from the British police.
The police service, working with the National Crime Agency, has never been so robust in this field. We are arresting over 400 men every month. We are safeguarding over 500 children every month as a result of targeting those people that would view indecent imagery of children. But the fact is, we are simply becoming inundated with the number of referrals that we are having to deal with and the number of cases that our child protection teams are now having to cope with.
They are asking the government not to jail every paedophile. Why? They've reached saturation point. They have 400 per month, and they just can't cope.
And we have sophisticated risk assessment tools that I am as confident as I can be will be able to determine whether or not an individual poses a risk of contact abusing a child.
Why? Why is this going on? We live in a sex-obsessed society. We live where there's so much easy access to this. We live in a society where people are told your sexual desires must be satisfied or you're not fulfilled. And yet, the constant pornography, the constant perversion, the constant selfishness, the constant lack of intimacy, it's just going to lead from one thing to another. I think that our Western liberal view of sex and sexuality is dehumanizing humans. It's turning us into no better than rutting rabbits. And, you know, this is where we as Christians have got something else to say. No, I am not going to defend Christian hypocrites. We can be tempted in every way, just as other people are. I'm not going to defend Christian hypocrites. I'm not going to defend people who use their clerical position to abuse small children. That's absolutely outrageous and disgusting. And I'm not going to justify an attitude towards sex, which itself is derogatory and harmful. But I am going to defend a Christian viewpoint about sex being intimacy within the context of marriage. And I'm saying, out of that, you're going to end up with hundreds of people who are paedophiles not being able to be jailed, because we can't afford to jail them, because it's just over, the tide of it is absolutely overwhelming us.
And when you look at the number of resources that we now have working within this field, you look at the numbers that we are now having to deal with, I am proposing that we have to take a slightly different approach, whereby and all individuals will still be arrested, but there are alternative solutions rather than putting these people through the court system, who are now dealing with between 40 and 50% of all their time are unfortunately allegations of sexual abuse. Cases are taking too long to come to court, and we have to look at an alternative whereby those individuals that we assess as posing little risk to children of contact abuse have to attend some form of rehabilitation course, have to attend a course whereby they are educated as to the impact of their abuse, the impact of their offending, whereby they are not then put into the justice system itself.
on the paedophile thing, let's just go one more. Councils have been told. Now, every week we give you one unbelievable fact, and please, we don't make these things up. Councils in Britain have been told not to name streets after local heroes in case they're later found out to be paedophiles and it costs them a fortune to rename the streets. No comment. That's the crazy world in which we live in. Well, you may want to escape that world. So let's think about the apocalypse and let's think about preppers. Now, preppers sounds like something that you would say at a very public school boy. Have you had your preppers yet? Well, no, apparently... this is wonderful. Preppers are billionaires who are heading off to New Zealand or California, whatever. Many of them are super rich Americans, and many of them are Silicon Valley tycoons and East Coast financiers, and they are buying up farms with bunkers and, you know, private helicopter pads and so on. One man says this: I keep a helicopter gassed up all the time, and I have an underground bunker with an air filtration system. There's something called the Survival Condo Project, which is a 15-story luxury apartment complex built underground in a disused nuclear missile silo in Kansas. It contains 12 apartments and can support 75 people with enough food and fuel to last for more than 5 years. In a crisis, the project's armed guards will pick up the prospective inhabitants in armored cars within a range of 400 miles. Are they serious about this? What are they worrying about it? Well, they've got money to burn, so I guess they're preparing for every eventuality. They are seeing, as we have said before, a growing gap between rich and poor, and they think that utopia is not going to happen. It's going to be a dystopia, and this apparently seems very common in Silicon Valley, where the technology industry is so much based. Is it just an American thing? Well, there is one on a farm in Bedfordshire, in England, and there is one in central Germany as well. Well, preparing for the coming apocalypse. Sorry, guys, there's nothing you can do to prepare for that. We need to prepare for the coming of the Lord, which is the ultimate judgment that no bunker will ever shelter you from. Let's move on from that, and let's talk about media perceptions of Christianity.
While my time in America isn't directly relevant, I think it gives me an extra layer of experience to draw on.
Absolutely, that's very impressive.
I hope I'm not blowing my own trumpet too much here.
If I had a trumpet this good, I'd be blowing it non-stop. Look, I think we're done here, so... I mean, obviously, I can't say anything official right now, but you should expect a phone call.
Thank you.
Tracy Ullman is a British comedian.
I just find it so difficult to boast on my CV. It's just that, as a Christian, I...
Oh. What? You're a...
Christian.
Yeah, okay.
Is that a...
No, not at all. You don't seem to mention it anywhere here.
Well, why would I?
No, fair point.
I'm not planning to run your polymer factory along biblical lines.
No. Could you just give me a second, please?
And at times, she's quite funny. She's got some very good impressions of Angela Merkel and Nicola Sturgeon and so on. I was across in Northern Ireland this weekend, and somebody came up to me and said, have you seen Tracy Ullman's skit about a Christian applying for a job? I said, no. I went back and I had a look at it. It's an incredible skit. We'll put the link to it. Have a look at it.
Denise, may I borrow you for a second? I'm just interviewing Patricia Hughes here.
Oh, Patricia. How wonderful to meet you. Do you know, we're all so excited that you've applied for this role. It's really very flattering when somebody of your caliber. Okay.
But this is where we've got to in our culture, where a mainstream comedian can make a joke which carries cultural resonance about a Christian being refused job because they let slip in the interview that they are actually a Christian. Some people have misunderstood Ullman's thing. She thinks she's mocking Christianity. No, she's not. I think she's actually a practicing Roman Catholic. She's not mocking Christianity. She's mocking the people who say that they're tolerant but would exclude a Christian because of their job. There's a lovely line in it where it goes kind of along the lines of...
There's a problem with me being a Christian, isn't there?
Absolutely not, legally speaking.
Is there a problem with my being a Christian? No, not legally. But not legally. But in reality, often there is.
But you both seem uncomfortable for some reason. Do you think that it makes me untrustworthy?
No.
Incompetent?
Mm-mm.
A bit weird?
I see.
Well, in that case, I'll just withdraw my application.
Oh, now.
And in case you think that's grossly exaggerated, and often it could be, I can tell you of a group of bankers and others who meet in the City of London in secret because they don't want their companies to know that they are Christians. They feel that they, when they have a Bible study, they just have to keep it quiet. An appalling state of affairs. Sometimes comedy gets the reality of our situation better than some of our so-called cultural analysis.
It's funny, isn't it? It's been perfectly normal to be a Christian in this country for the last 1,500 years or so. But now, well...
Really sorry about this.
It's fine. I forgive you.
Lucky escape.
Yeah, what a nutter.
And let's stick with our culture. There's a lot of talk in the British press just now about the possibility of European citizens being forced to go back to the EU if they don't get citizenship and so on. And there are some very, very legitimate concerns there. But I didn't see any fuss at all about Belgium being sued by a Syrian Christian family who fled from Aleppo to Lebanon after one family member was kidnapped and tortured and they've been refused asylum. Belgium has gone to the European courts in order to refuse this family asylum. So here's the paradox. I think rightly, by the way, many European countries are welcoming many refugees who are Muslims. I'm not saying they shouldn't welcome them. However, it does become disturbing if they end up creating ghettos, and it becomes even more disturbing if those who are Christians who are fleeing genuine persecution are sent back. There's a problem there. There's something not right. I can think of one lady who got in touch with me last week from the Middle East who has become a Christian and who is now in this country and who wants to apply for asylum. I have a strange suspicion. If she said that she was lesbian and likely to be persecuted if she went back to her native land, I have a suspicion that she'd be okay. She'd be able to stay. Saying that she's become Christian.
You're a...
Christian?
Yeah, okay.
Is that a...
No, not at all. You don't seem to mention it anywhere here.
Well, why would I?
Where she almost certainly, given the country it is and given the record, at the very least she will go to jail. It could be worse than that. But I think that our press and our government couldn't care two hoots.
There's a problem with me being a Christian, isn't there?
Absolutely not, legally speaking.
Maybe we should get Tracy Ullman to do a wee sketch about something like this, where you have a refugee coming in and saying, look, I feel I'm going to be persecuted, and the Home Office official says, oh, we really do need to help you, and we need to do the best that we can for you. And, you know, maybe they could say, I'm gay or whatever, and, oh, okay, we need to help you. And they would say, actually, I've become a Christian. You're going home. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm just being paranoid. We'll see, because I'm going to fight her case.
Lucky escape.
Yeah, what a nutter.
This is my favourite wacko story of the week. A man spent 2 days in Texas standing under a loose supermarket sign for Walmart because he noticed that one of the letters on the sign was loose and he was hoping it would fall off and hit him on the head and he could sue the store. And another crazy story for this week, because we've had so much heavy stuff. There's a workman's cafe in central France. Got a lot of bookings when suddenly it was awarded a Michelin star. Now, why was it awarded a Michelin star? It La Bouche à Auriel in Bourges serves home-cooked lasagna, beef bourguignon on plastic tablecloths with plastic cups and so on. It's just a basic workman's cafe. How did it get a Michelin star? The answer is it didn't. It's like this comes back where we came in with the Oscars. It was a case of mistaken identity and it was somewhere else and they had to apologize. But can you imagine all these fancy diners treating them? Oh, it's absolutely wonderful. I think what a marvelous job you've done. It's so authentic. Well, that's because it was authentic and it was just pub grub. Wonderful. Love it.
I started crying when I lost my stars.
You started crying?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very emotional thing for any chef.
And now let's just come to a couple of people who have died. both of whom will be missed in this world. One is Gerald Kaufman. Gerald Kaufman's a senior Labour MP. In fact, he's the father of the House of Parliament. Of Jewish background, he, to my mind, was an example of a great MP. He didn't necessarily agree with him. He had this caustic wit. That the Labour Party could do with people like him now. He had this passionate sense of social justice. And just a reminder to me that politics is about individuals and people, not so much about ideologies. He will be missed. He really, really, really will be missed. And then there's another man who many of you may not have heard of, Hans Rosling, who is described as a global health expert, data visionary, a Swede who, they love him on TED Talks, and he managed to present statistics and data and analysis. Now, if you want facts about population and so on, you really do need to go and read some of Hans Rosling's stuff. And I think he's done a huge amount to help improve the world. One of the things I didn't know, I listened to a long obituary of him, and this doesn't get mentioned in the minor obituaries. He's a Swede, but he was also a Christian. And it was his Christian faith that drove him to seek the truth in the facts. And I think that's a very, very good place for us to finish. Quantum of Solace is about providing opinions, my opinions, opinions of others around. But it's also about trying to analyze what's happening. It's about trying to provide facts, even if they're facts that are uncomfortable for us. It's about trying to think the bigger picture of what's going on in this world and how does the gospel come in. And again, as we did last week, we come back to this question of truth. As I came into the studio this morning, I was listening, as one does, to BBC Radio 4 programme on Nietzsche. And they were discussing him, and they said one of the things that Nietzsche really disliked was truth. And I found that fascinating. Nietzsche, the atheist, backed away from his Lutheran upbringing. And he thought the concept of truth was very dangerous. So it is, and that's why we bring you the truth as it is in Jesus. God bless you.
Yo. We're part of a culture that really loves to hate us. Every chance they get, they attempt to isolate and debate us. It's not that they don't like us, it's just they don't like God in us. It's common knowledge, and oddly enough, it makes a lot of sense to a lot of us. We completely understand because we used to occupy the same space and lived in a similar type state until we tasted of God's grace. So we continue loving this world that so easily rejects us and passionately press past the lack of their cultural acceptance. And as if there weren't enough problems for us gaining influence, we keep fighting over the issue of what's too worldly of a Christian to make a difference. So no matter how you paint it, or politically campaign it, whether you water it down and drain it, it's really all the same, ain't it? It's the same frustration, same constant segregation. Christians living like aliens trying to relate with citizens of a different nation. What always makes for a better presentation than bark and bite is a proper understanding of living life filled with salt and light. So we walk this fine line of walking in light of God's kindness and live with a sense of worldliness without the fear of compromising. Loving God and neighbor until Christ comes to split the sky or die in a society hailing Jesus as Messiah. Yep.